Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, August 7th. I'm Ray Graff. President Trump has put American trade practices under a microscope, at times instituting tariffs on China, Canada, Mexico, and members of the EU. The moves have led to retaliatory measures. Some American businesses, such as manufacturers and farmers, say those are hurting them. How is this impacting the economy? What does it mean for you? Economist Hugh Johnson returns to the show for today's discussion and to answer your questions. The number to call is 800-348-2551. That's 1-800-348-2551. You may also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Hugh Johnson, your calls and emails coming up on the show. We begin after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Some in Washington and elsewhere have been sounding the alarm for a potential trade war as President Trump institutes tariffs on China, Canada, Mexico, and members of the European Union. Those decisions have led to retaliation against American goods. What effect is all of this having on the U.S. economy? What does it mean for you? Well, joining us to answer your questions is Hugh Johnson. He is a partner with Hugh Johnson Advisors, LLC, in Albany, New York. Hugh is an economic advisor to the chairman of the New York State Assembly Committee on Ways and Means, a professor at Union Clarkson Graduate College, a former member of the New York Stock Exchange. Hugh Johnson, welcome back to the show.
Ray, it's great to be with you.
Our number here is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. If you want to ask Hugh a question, or you can email us, voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. So glad you're here. Can you please explain to the layman, me, many others, first of all, why the Trump administration instituted tariffs, what they're doing, and what it means for the average man on the street?
Well, I think really the reason they're instituting the tariffs more than anything is promises made by President Trump during the campaign, where he said he wanted to change things in Washington, that he wanted it American first. And of course, you've heard all the slogans, and his view is, his basic view is that, and it's a view I might add that is shared by some of his advisors who have been encouraging him along this path. But the point being is that he's thought that the world trade is unfair. That China's unfair, particularly when it comes to intellectual property, that other countries are levying significant tariffs on the import of goods from the U.S., and it's making our goods and services uncompetitive, and therefore it's putting us at a disadvantage when we're trying to sell things to other parts of the world. And he wanted to change that. He wanted to level the playing field. He didn't think that the World Trade Organization or that kind of jurisdictional process would be helpful in getting the playing field leveled. And so he wanted to do something about it. So he's strong-arming a lot of countries around the world to try to get them not just to reduce their tariffs, but hopefully throughout the world to eliminate tariffs or to have a completely level playing field where there are no tariffs and everybody competes, again, on a level playing field.
Is his basic point, does it have some validity?
Yeah, it does. There's always some validity. There's always some truth into some of the things he does say, especially when it comes to China, especially when it comes to, you know, a little I know. And again, I haven't been doing the trade negotiations, so it's hard to really completely understand it. But when it comes to intellectual property, we've known for years that China has practices which enables them to steal intellectual property or the technology secrets, if that's the way to say it, of some U.S. companies, and then to produce them in China and to produce products as a result of that compete with U.S. companies. That's unfair, and we know that's unfair. There are plenty of other examples around the world, though, where, and sometimes for good reason, that's the important thing to, I think, keep in mind, where countries do levy tariffs in order to protect, and I think the word is protect is the most important word, to protect some of their fledgling industries which are trying to survive and become competitive in the world. They protect those industries. We saw that particularly in the case of South Korea for years and years.
In the beginning, the European Union, first of all, I think to a large extent agrees with President Trump that China has been trying to and successfully taking technological secrets. Yes. The EU on board with that. Yeah. Why then the tariffs also in effect now on European Union countries?
That's being negotiated, first of all. We don't know for sure. I mean, in most cases, of course, steel and aluminum, 25%, yes. Automobiles, that's still being negotiated. Whether it goes beyond automobiles to many, many other products. The latest word I have, and again, this is everybody should keep in mind that what I say you should treat gingerly, and that's because this has been an on and again, off again type of a process. One day we're talking about negotiations that looked like they're going to be headed towards a successful conclusion. Other days we're talking about the so-called get tough again, and we're going to impose tariffs on every product that we import. In most cases, they say import from China, but it could be any country in the world. So it's on again, off again, and there's no real resolution to a lot of these trade disputes. Some, yes, there's resolution, but in many cases, there's no resolution or clarity quite yet.
Is there any rhyme or reason to the hot and cold, on again, off again, get tough, get easy policy? Is this a strategy, or is this just whichever way the wind blows?
No, I don't. It may be just whichever way the wind blows, and it certainly appears that way when you watch it unfolding in front of your eyes. You know, sometimes it's threats. It's the bully in the playground, threatening to impose tariffs on products that are being sold to us by other countries in the world, and that worries other countries in the world. It's trying to get them to change their practices. It's threatening. It's just simply that simple. It's just issuing threats in order to get countries to change their practices. And quite frankly, in many cases, there are threats to get countries to change their practices when really, when you look at the numbers, their trade policies, or let's say their tariffs, and it's sometimes hard to calculate them, but their tariffs are the same as ours.
Hugh Johnson is our guest today. The number's 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Before we get to the phones, Hugh, you know, the media loves buzz phrases, and so now it's trade war. We get in a trade war?
Let's call it a skirmish, not a war. The real question is, and the real worry is that we're going to have something that's somewhat similar to the widespread trade war that we had that started in June of 1930, not 1929, although there's just, gosh, a lot going on with regard to trade in 1929, but it was 1930 when we had big the Smoot-Hawley tariffs. And the worry is, of course, that contributed to, if not created, and I don't believe it created, and it did contribute to sort of a deflationary environment or the Depression. Mm-hmm. And that the worry is that there'll be a widespread trade war in the sense of 25% tariffs on everything that anybody tries to sell to us. Complete protectionism, complete isolation. I don't think that's in the cards. That's only a guess. You never know where these negotiations are going to head, or you know, there's obviously everybody's playing it tough right now, particularly the U.S. and particularly China. But I don't think, I doubt seriously, because it would have such a significant impact on global economic activity. The current consensus forecast is, these are just numbers, but the IMF believes that the global economy is going to grow 3.9%. in this year, 2018, as well as 2019, they have not changed that forecast, even though they know what's going on. Mm-hmm. That the 3.9% would turn in a global trade war environment, would turn into 1.9%, which means positive economic growth in a lot of countries like India and China, but negative economic growth or a recession in other parts of the world, perhaps the U.S. I don't think that's in the cards. I want to restate that. But nevertheless, there is the worry that we would get to that extreme. It's not good news.
Hugh Johnson is our guest today. The number is 800-348-2551. Let's take a call before the first break. Harrison in Newburgh. Harrison, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Two quick things. One is this assumption that there is such a thing as a level playing field in terms of, it depends on your time frame you're looking at. If you just want to talk about the last 20 years, sure, there might be some sort of imbalance in the IP that's flowing from country to country. But if you really want to talk about the worldwide, structural system of of fairness and justice, I would say that the U.S. and most of the Western world has had plenty of advantages that they have not shared with the rest of the world in terms of resource extraction as well as military intervention. And secondly, real quick, I would like to for the an answer with this is how would in terms of like the trade situation with China not benefit any other countries that will you know band together and as your guest said be a detriment to the U.S. economy?
Two good questions, or maybe they're comments more than questions, and I appreciate it. And you're really quite right to talk about the benefits of the U.S. You know, when you take a look at tariffs, and there are people that economists, certainly economists that are far better at this than myself, that have calculated the level of tariffs to include subsidies for companies for all countries in the world, and it's fairly clear that it's, first of all, not a level playing field. But the most important thing is to understand is, I think, that the level of tariffs really for most of the major Western trading partners are pretty close to being the same. And a lot of these countries do, as you've suggested, receive a lot of benefits from the U.S. that are not have nothing to do with trade. And I'm trying to remember what your second question is, which second part point, which is about the banning of countries banning together to try to take advantage of the fact that trade between China and the U.S. is interrupted. And that's already been discussed. It's already being discussed. These kind of trade consortiums are already being formed. There are countries that are stepping into the breach, so to speak, to take trade away from the U.S. and to benefit themselves. And that's already being done.
All right, Harrison, thanks for the call. We have to take a break. Our guest today is Hugh Johnson, and we talk tariffs and the economy. 800-348-2551 is the number. 800-348-2551. We'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. The number is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Hugh Johnson is our guest. You can also email the program, voxpop@wamc.org. By the way, the National Weather Service has issued a severe thunderstorm warning for Albany, Rensselaer, and Saratoga counties in New York until 3:15. So, thunderstorm warning, Albany, Rensselaer, and Saratoga counties until 3:15 today. We'll keep you posted. All right, Hugh, before we get back to the phone calls, and the topic at hand, just something a little more local. GE Power announced today it's laying off 200 workers at its Schenectady facility. The company's workforce in the capital region has drastically declined over the years. How do those losses impact the area's economy?
First of all, it's the impact is largely obviously going to be on Schenectady County. And you take a look at the performance of the different counties, and we're talking about Rensselaer County, Albany County, and certainly Schenectady County, but also taking a look at what's happening in Glens Falls and Saratoga. And there's a big difference between all of them. And I hate to say this, but unfortunately, in the work that I do on counties is that Schenectady has been struggling for quite some time, and of course a big part of it's General Electric. If you look at all the counties in upstate New York, we're talking about the bottom 5 to 10 counties. Schenectady's right in there. I hate to say it, a slight loss of employment, a slight loss projected also in my work for 2017-2018, despite the real progress they're making with a lot of things that are going on in Schenectady. They have some pretty imaginative, creative, and aggressive development going on, but facing that headwind. And the headwind is General Electric. Fortunately, I think the leaders, the political leaders and business leaders in Schenectady have recognized that they can't depend or lean on General Electric anymore. They've recognized that years ago, not just recent. And they're trying to develop and attract other businesses. We're seeing some real technology being done over there. Some things are really being done that are very promising. But every time I crunch the numbers, I come up with, unfortunately, it's still at the bottom of the list. Now, it doesn't have to stay at the bottom of the list. Rensselaer County used to be at the bottom of the list or near the bottom of the list, not quite as low as Schenectady, but used to be. And it's now getting up there. It's not as high or as impressive as Saratoga. Saratoga is actually, in many ways, the number one county in upstate New York. It's really impressive. Rensselaer was down, and now it's up, and it's up because of a lot of Regenerons, a lot of development, a lot of businesses. So it pays off. Good public policy pays off, but it takes time. It takes a lot of patience, and they're making the right steps in Schenectady, and sooner or later it'll pay off, but not right now.
When you say good policy pays off, that means lower taxes, incentives?
It has to be incentives. You have to have reasons to attract businesses. You have to make sure that they don't have to go through a permitting process. You have to attract businesses. Look at it. This is all about attracting businesses, and you have to have a really good labor force, a creative labor force that's technologically competent. That has to be available to companies that are moving into the area. Otherwise, they won't move into the area. You have to have tax incentives. You have to have an easy process, regulatory process to go through. You can't have a difficult permitting process. You do that and they won't come. And all these kinds of things. There's a lot of things that companies look at. Schenectady, I think, is aware of this, and I think they're moving in that direction, but it just takes time. It takes patience. They're not there yet.
For a brief moment there, you almost sounded like President Trump, who said, you know, there's too much red tape in business. Has there been too many regulatory hurdles in years past?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. In any business, I'm looking at this, and you ask a great question. I look at it from the point of view of my industry, which is the financial services business, where there's been plenty of regulation, too much regulation. Does regulation inhibit you doing business? And I'm not talking just about federal regulation. I'm talking about state regulation too, which is it costs money. Number one, it's not free. It costs money. And the second thing is it takes time, which also costs money. And it makes it very difficult to compete. Some regulation is very necessary. I don't disagree with that. And you have to have it. But I think that regulation over the course of the last 10 years has gone too far. Folks sometimes join government, parts of government, and they come up with, I don't know why they do it, but they come up with regulations because that's their job. But in many cases, it simply goes too far and makes it difficult for businesses to do well.
Hugh Johnson is our guest today on Vox Pop. The number is 800-348-2551. And we'll get back to the phones in a minute. If you've been hanging on the line, hang in there another moment or two. Getting back to Schenectady and, in general, the GE cuts, we have seen a very low unemployment rate across the country. And one question I have, maybe you can figure this out for me. Maybe it's simple and I'm missing the point. We've had low unemployment, and in theory, wages rise at that point, right? Why has that lagged?
First of all, one of the reasons we've got low unemployment, let's be careful about that, because a lot of times labor forces are either not growing at a very rapid pace or they're actually declining. So if you add one job and the labor force goes down, the unemployment rate goes down. That's arithmetic. So don't be impressed by the fact that you have a low unemployment rate. The second thing is that you have to look at not just can't look at the stuff at the top of the sort of the headlines. You have to look at the number of discouraged workers or workers that are called marginally attached to the workforce. There are a lot of them, and there have been a lot of them for a long time, especially discouraged workers. Those numbers are improving. The number that are marginally attached to the workforce is coming down. The number of discouraged workers are coming down. They're joining the labor force. And so actually the growth rate of the labor force is starting to pick up a little bit. All of that's really good news. It even has further to go. But the point being is that when there's a little more excess or slack in the employment situation than you'd otherwise see if you just looked at the very low unemployment rate. And the reason that there isn't upward pressure is not upward pressure on wages. There's some. It's 2.5%, 2.6%. And the reason you don't see it on a year-over-year basis. The reason you don't see it is because, again, there are so many workers that are discouraged, but they're very clearly coming off and building the labor force and putting and keeping downward pressure on wages. That's going to change, though. We're getting toward the end of that whole process, and sooner or later, I would say probably a little bit later, maybe late 2019, we'll start to see some upward pressure on wages.
Our guest today is Hugh Johnson, and the number is 800-348-2551 on Vox Pop. And let's go back to the phones. Jill in Waterford. Jill, you're on.
Hi. I was going to ask a Tariff 101 question.
Okay.
However, since you brought up the topic of attracting businesses and how to attract businesses, I'm going to forego my Tariff 101 question.
Well, okay.
My issue, I'm all for attracting businesses. I'm all for hiring as many people as possible. However, there has got to be a better way to do it besides giving them tax incentives. The reason I say that is because you give businesses tax incentives, and who ends up having to take up the slack? The residents. If you cut back on regulation, who ends up picking up the slack or suffering because the businesses are either polluting or you end up with a financial system like in 2008? And who ends up picking up the slack? The residents. So there's got to be a better way to do it besides tax incentives and cutting regulation.
Okay.
It's extremely competitive to try to attract businesses. It's a dog-eat-dog situation. I hate to be so crude, but I do know people in public life, not just in New York State, but also in neighboring states like Massachusetts and Vermont, particularly Vermont. And I know how dear to their souls attracting business, because they're losing businesses. Their unemployment rates are low because they're losing their labor force because they can't attract business. And it's extremely competitive, and you can make strong arguments. And I agree with you. It'd be great to have the right tax incentives, the right regulation. I don't know what it is, but I do know that it's extremely competitive. And if we, meaning Schenectady in this case, want to attract business, you have to compete. And that means you have to offer incentives. And every business that relocates does not want the highest tax. This is not all about the highest tax incentive. This is all about a, let's call it a package or a configuration of variables that will make it attractive to that business. And if you want to compete, you have to have the right configuration of variables, or the business is going to go elsewhere. And it's just that simple. I don't know the right answer, but that's
how does one do that when, for example, GE, I can remember when GE was booming, and in order to get their taxes reduced, they kept moving or laying off or closing parts of the plant. But the problem is the streets still have to be paved, the lights still have to be on, and the only people left are the residents, who end up with a bigger tax burden.
Well, that's true.
That was the whole point. That was the whole point when they were saying, you know, getting businesses to pay their fair share.
Okay.
Well,
I couldn't agree with you more. But I think what you ought to do, what I would invite you to do, is read about the what has become a success story. Wasn't always a success story. Austin, Texas, and we used Austin, Texas, not completely as a model, but something to learn from. And when we talked about global foundries and the relocation of technology companies to this area of the world, and they made a lot of mistakes in Austin, and they corrected those mistakes. And right now, if you talk to people in Austin, they made those changes And absolutely the stuff that you're talking about, changes in tax codes, changes in regulations, and it's become a success story. At least that's the impression I get from talking to people down there. So I would invite you to take a look at Austin, Texas, and maybe you'll find some of the answers.
Hugh Johnson is our guest today on Vox Pop, and the number is 800-348-2551. You're one of the economic advisors to the New York State Assembly Committee on Ways and Means. In your estimation, you know, we've heard so much over the decades about jobs and just leaving upstate New York. And New York has, politicians have been throwing some money around in upstate New York in an attempt to create jobs and have companies come in. And have they done a good job?
Look, they've tried.
Well.
But there is a lot of money that's being, there's been an effort to try to rejuvenate upstate New York, particularly when you look at the upstate numbers versus the downstate numbers. They have not improved. Downstate is still where the, I don't want to say where the action is, that's not the right way to say it. But the numbers, the growth rates of employment in downstate are simply stronger than upstate New York, almost across the board. And there's lots of reasons for that. They have bigger economies. They're far more diversified. They've been very successful. They're building on success. That's not going to change anytime soon. Upstate New York is as far as I can see, for 2018-19, and I would say 2020 would be my guess. I haven't forecasted that one. Upstate New York is going to be behind in employment growth, the growth rate of employment. And there are other parts of New York State. Upstate New York there are a lot of different parts of upstate New York. You take a look at Elmira. You take a look at Broome County. They're really struggling. They need a lot of help. I've looked at the amount of money. We all talk about the $1 billion, whatever it is, for Buffalo.
Yeah.
My numbers for Buffalo are still not improving. Their employment situation is still not getting better, according to the numbers that I'm looking at. And I don't see any change in that in 2018-19, despite all the money that's been spent up there. I wish I knew the answers. I wish we all knew the answers. But right now, it appears to me, and I'm not talking about negative growth, except maybe in some place like Elmira. I'm talking about low positive growth in 2018 and 2019 versus stronger growth in downstate New York. And that, I know they're trying to make a change, but it is not going to change anytime soon, in my view.
Hugh Johnson is our guest today on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551, the number. We go to Richard in Schenectady. Richard, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon, Hugh and Ray.
Hi.
Hello.
Now, I've had this, I've been wondering about this several months since I've heard about the unemployment rate going down to quite a bit of a low. And then I just heard what you said a little while ago about you have to be careful about how you interpret the low unemployment rate and whether the labor force is shrinking. But I think you said it seems to be growing. So
yes.
I don't know if that invalidates the premise to my question, so I'm just going to ask it anyways. We hear about machines and robots replacing a lot of human jobs. And, how does that how do you explain that and the fact that the labor force or the unemployment rate is going down at the same time? It doesn't seem like those two facts are compatible.
Well, they are, but let me explain it this way. If you took a look at the top 10 companies, the highest, largest 10 companies in 1990 and compared them with the top 10 today, you'd see something very interesting. And what you would see is that their revenues have expanded or grown, the top 10. These are not the same top 10 today as they were in 1990.
Okay.
But if you saw that, you'd say the revenues of the top 10 are now 350% higher. But the level of employment by the top 10 are only 37% higher. Mm. And that simply reflects a fact that's fundamental to what's going on in this world of ours. And what's going on in this world of ours is that we're moving from a labor-intensive economy to a knowledge-driven economy. And that's been made possible by, you said robots, but just call it the exponential progress in technology. We can do a lot more with fewer people right now. And then I talked a little bit about the number of people that are discouraged, the number of people that are marginally attached to the workforce. I had talked about that a little while ago. And the reason that you have discouraged workers and marginally attached to the workforce is they effectively cannot find jobs. And they cannot find jobs. It's difficult to find jobs because, again, we're shifting from a labor-intensive to a knowledge-intensive economy. That's not going to change anytime soon. Think about artificial intelligence and what that means for companies and how profitable they're going to be. So the point being this is you've got a labor force, which you're right. I'm not saying shrinking. I'm saying growing at a very slow pace, call it 0.5%, where it ordinarily would grow 1 to 1.5%. You know, if you have a labor force that's growing 0.5% and you do have some job growth, say 0.6%, you're going to get a decline in the unemployment rate. Yeah. But that doesn't tell you the story about what's going on. What tells you the story about what's going on is you got to look much more closely. You ask the question, how about the haves and the have-nots? We always talk about the equality, income inequality. And boy, it certainly exists. Part of the reason for the income inequality is anybody who does not have the technical skills is going to be one of those discouraged workers, and they won't have any income. And that's the problem. This is all being driven by, it's being driven, in my view, by exponential progress in technology. And I don't see that changing anytime soon.
Well, that's not very optimistic, Hugh Johnson.
Well, it isn't optimistic. It's a fact of, well, I'm not saying it's a fact of life. It's a projection by me. And it's a trend that seems to be unfolding, and it seems to be been unfolding for a number of years. You know, we 10 years ago, we didn't talk about income inequality to the extent that we're talking about income inequality today. And I talked about it 10 years ago. I'm not patting my chest. I'm saying I saw it coming, and I saw the exponential progress in technology. I saw it coming, and I saw what that would mean, that you'd have a lot of disenfranchised workers, and that would present policymakers with an enormous problem, an enormous social problem. What do you do about that? And if you want to say, well, what is the answer? I don't know what the answer is.
Well, let's find out after the break. I bet Hugh will think about it for 90 seconds, and he'll have that answer. Our number is 800-348-2551. Tomorrow never knows. 800-348-2551. We'll be right back. Hugh Johnson is our guest today on Vox Pop. The number is 800-348-2551. We talked the economy and tariffs and some terrifying views of the future. By the way, the National Weather Service has issued a severe thunderstorm warning for Albany, Rensselaer, Saratoga counties in New York until 3:15. Just heard a little thunder. This one came in via email, Hugh, and then we'll go back to the phones. This is from Jude in Woodstock. And the subject heading, it's a very long subject heading. What about climate as a positive to capitalize for upstate New York and now and future versus climate impacts in the Southwest and California? And then the question goes on, and how can the markets keep going while the impact of climate on life on Earth takes an ever greater toll on humanity, gradually taking the whole enchilada down? Talk about another depressing question.
That was not only a depressing question, but one that I don't have an answer for. There's no question, and I think that, you know, the concerns about the environment are well-founded, particularly given the position of the current administration. That's not to tell you what political party I'm associated with, affiliated with, or even a supporter of, but it's just simply the ignoring the basic facts of life. And it's obviously over time we're going to have the impact of the environment on our economy. I think that you're probably overstating it, that when you say it's going to bring the, whatever the expression might be.
She said whole enchilada.
The whole enchilada down. I think that's probably all overstating it. The economy will do what it always does, is shift. Technology will come in, and there'll be significant shifts in the economy, but it's not going to be the collapse of the economy. Go back to the Club of Rome in 1980. Very interesting when they thought the world was going to run out of food. The next thing you saw is technology change that changed, for example, India from being a net importer of food to being a net exporter. Mm-hmm. Well, what were those technology changes? They learned how to store food. They learned how to transport food before it rotted. I mean, these were really basic technological advances in India that turned them again into an exporter of food, not an importer of food. But technology came to the rescue despite the dire warnings of the Club of Rome that we were going to run out of food in the world.
But yet technology, as you stated in the last break, before our underwriting break, has to some extent made the future a little bleak for employment.
Yeah,
go
sure
50
has.
Years down the road. What happens then?
I wish I knew the answer to that. And it's the answer I have now, which is the same useless answer that I had 10 years ago, which is it's going to put a lot of pressure. And I've said it 10 years ago, and I'll say it again today. It's going to put a lot of pressure on public policy. And I'm afraid that's where we're going to have to try to find the solutions. What is the solution? Shared work weeks? Don't know. There are lots of ideas. None of the ideas seem to be very satisfactory. But quite frankly, you will have companies, and we're seeing this now. We do have companies that are able to do a lot more with fewer, and therefore their profit margins. If there's one aspect of the stock market now that really jumps out at you, is the profits are soaring.
Yeah.
Despite all the public policy problems we have in Washington, the dysfunction, the incredible dysfunction, the stock market is soaring, and the stock market is soaring in part because of profits being so high. That's simply a reflection of what I'm talking about. And will corporations be able to have the good-heartedness to help solve this problem for the many people that lose their jobs down the road? I haven't a clue.
One would think they would have to, otherwise capitalism is doomed.
Well, let's just say there may have to be some adjustments.
One more email and then back to the phones we will go. This one is from Mark. It seems like all sectors of the economy have been affected by the Great Recession. All sectors except colleges and universities. The cost of college is higher now than it has ever been. What can be done to rein in the ever-climbing cost of higher education in this country? And that's from Mark.
That's a great question. The ever higher cost of education and, of course, the mounting levels of debt that are associated with those ever rising costs of education, you're likely to see, first of all, demographics are changing. And the demand for a college education is starting to come under a little bit of pressure. Potential students are now looking at return on invested capital. If I'm going to spend $70,000, $100,000 a year, parents and students, but mostly parents, are saying, what am I going to get out of it? What's going to be my return on invested capital? There's real competition coming into it now. There are actually the right questions are being asked. As a result of that, what you do see in many instances, particularly graduate schools, and we've seen it locally in Albany, what you're seeing is that that enrollments are down. Enrollments are down, which in some cases schools are going out of business or emerging.
Yeah.
We saw the recent issues with Albany Law School, where their enrollment or their number of enrollees was down by 30%. That's not the case anymore. It was down significantly. As a result, they had to entertain the idea of combining with SUNY. The point is that the demographics are changing. There's more competition. There are some schools that are going to go out of business. And the way I know this, the way economics works, in a world that had a bubble, the bubble being tuitions and the cost of an education, and schools were competing with each other to build the next football stadium, that is slowly, slowly changing. And it's changing because of economic reality. And the economic reality is that students are now asking the right questions and enrollment is going down and some schools are going to go out of business. That's exactly what should happen. And it will happen. And over time, I don't think the cost of an education will come down. It'll go up at a much slower pace.
Oh, well, that's bad news for all of us who have children about to enter the college years.
I've got some grandchildren, and they're visiting me from California, and they're coming into town today, and they've got their hands out and saying, how am I going to pay for an education? Yeah. It's everybody's problem.
Yeah, let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551, the number. Hugh Johnson is our guest. Beth in Niskayuna. Beth, you're on.
Hi, this is an old fact from your station about the growth of the dairy industry, the yogurt industry in New York State, as a positive. And then I'm going to throw this also out there. Besides the fact that it's not big business deciding it's going to be kind, it's always been the labor movement that has forced the hand of big business. But big business has been hiring temporary workers from overseas, and I'm not talking about Mexico either. So they're allowed to offer packages to individuals and pay them less than they would in this country, and that's a problem.
All right, you?
Well, you know, it's what you'll hear every day. This may contradict what I've said before about discouraged workers, workers on the margin of the workforce. I think every business, and I don't know what this has to do with dairy, but you'll have to explain that to me. But the point...
Well, the dairy was the aside thing. That was just saying that I understand you're talking about technology. I'm just mentioning New York State has a boom in the yogurt industry. It might be a small industry, but that's created jobs.
Okay.
But the other point I'm making is that businesses in America are hiring temporary workers from overseas because they can offer them contracts and fewer benefits and pay them less. And I'm not talking about brown skin people from Mexico either.
Okay, all right.
Okay, but first of all, there's tightness in the labor markets. If you look at just at the surface, at the unemployment rate, and if companies are complaining about anything, is they can't find workers. They can't find.
Well, they're trained overseas.
Okay.
Doesn't
matter. Doesn't matter. The point is that if you're running a company, you need a competent person to fill that job. You have to find them somewhere. And if they can't find them locally, and that's the complaint I keep hearing from companies, they're going to find them somewhere. The problem they're going to run into is they hire them from overseas, and you go through the whole immigration green card process. And first of all, I don't know what your experience has been, but I know what my experience, personal experience has been. It's very expensive and very difficult and very long and very laborious. So there are trade-offs. But the really what you're talking about is the response of companies to the tightness in the labor force, the complaint you hear all the time.
Beth,
I can't get workers.
Thank you very much for the call. We go over to Cookie in Albany. Cookie, you're on.
Hi, I have a pie-in-the-sky question for Mr. Johnson.
Oh, good.
Ignoring all the problems that you just mentioned about immigration, naturalization, and all that, what if the workforce could be created from the environment itself? You would need so many thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people to clean up the oceans, to move the pollution, blah, blah, blah. There is more work than I think there are people alive available to do it if you focus on this as a new business opportunity, don't you think? My only question is, how do you fit that into a capitalist model so that whoever decides to be crazy enough to invent this kind of thing can benefit from it, and so can the people who work in it.
That's not crazy.
I agree, it sounds nuts.
No, it's not crazy at all. If you look at the history of the U.S. economy, and you take a look at the shift from an agricultural economy to an industrial economy, and then from an industrial economy at least to the first stages of a knowledge-driven economy, those three major shifts, they were accompanied by a couple of things that really happened. First of all, we used to employ a lot of people in the agricultural component of the U.S. economy. There were new industries, and everything from a telephone to you name it, to light, that were created, that absorbed the folks that lost their jobs on the farm because driven in large part by technology. And they got jobs in the industrial sector of the economy. That shift was driven by technological innovation focused on the industrial sector of the U.S. economy. You're suggesting that there are going to be things that need to be done in the future, things that might be the development or creation of driven, inspired by technology. Possibly.
No, I'm saying we need it now, not in the future. It's already here.
Right.
The encroachment of poison, every kind of pollutant, every kind of, you know, loss of habitat. If you put that as a priority above all else, there will be millions of jobs.
I don't know what the numbers are. I hope you're right. Let's put
it
that way.
Well, Cookie, thanks a lot
for
the call.
Thank you. That's very good.
Hugh Johnson, our guest here, 800-348-2551. If you want to get in the waning moments of the program, 800-348-2551. Joseph in Old Chatham. Joseph, you're on.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
First of all, I just wanted to make one point about the goodness of corporations. Henry Ford was sued by in the early 1900s. When he tried to do something good for his employees. And the court ruled that the only duty a corporation has is to maximize profit. And so if you think the corporations are going to come to the rescue of people out of the goodness of their hearts, you're sadly mistaken. That's the first thing. The second point I'd like to make is that the only way to deal with this is to tax the rich. And that means the corporations. As the robots take over, you have to tax corporations and provide a basic income to people. And why would you do that? Because a corporate entity is an artificial creation of the state. It's not a person.
All right.
Those are my thoughts.
Hugh, what do you think?
I'd like to be a little more generous to corporations. I realize that you think that they, a very strong case could be made that their mandate from their owners, which are their shareholders, is simply to maximize profits and make the stock price go up. And I think to a large extent, you're right. And that's what drives a lot of decisions that are made by corporations. And the people that run corporations will agree with you, and they'll tell you that. It's not quite as deep in the hearts and minds of corporate executives as it once was. They actually do think about, and a lot of it's being driven, let's put it this way, a lot of it's being driven by the pressure that pension funds, such as the New York Common Retirement Fund, which is very socially conscious, and a lot of other pensions, which are important owners of U.S. companies, they're putting enormous pressure on companies for companies to do the right things, even if it entails changing their board of directors to make sure that there's minorities and women that are represented on the board of directors, and making changes in the practices of corporations so that they're, for example, more agreeable to what we take to be sensible environmental policy. So corporations, you may think, are entirely greedy, and I think to some extent they'll tell you, yes, we are. Yes, we are trying to maximize the profits and the shareholder price for our owners. They're not entirely that way, and part of the reason they're not entirely that way is because of the pressure being put on them by public pension funds. So that's just a consideration. I'm not saying I disagree with you. Taxing the rich and passing on the changing the tax laws to reduce the taxes on those that are middle class and are less fortunate, we were told that that's exactly what this tax law change did. We've looked at the numbers. I've looked at the numbers. You've looked at the numbers. Ain't true.
Well, Hugh Johnson, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for being here. Support comes from Boyden and Perrin, Amherst, Massachusetts, providing foreign and domestic car, truck, and SUV repair services at a Massachusetts inspection station for over 50 years. BoydenandPerrin.com. Kent Hicks Construction, specializing in deep energy retrofits, passive house, zero energy homes, and historic restorations, serving the Berkshires, Pioneer Valley, and all of western Massachusetts for over 25 years. KentHicksConstruction.com. Blue Sky Bicycles, Saratoga Springs, New York, now offering pedal assist electric bikes to the Capital Region, a new way to enjoy the outdoors. Test rides available, BlueSkyBicycles.com. And Hooked Seafood Company, Latham, fresh seafood retail market and kitchen with scratch-made lunch and dinner menu, raw bar, lobster rolls, whole belly clams, fish and chips available, HookedSeafoodINC.com. Thanks again to Hugh Johnson. Thank you for listening. Another Vox Pop tomorrow. Stand by for news.